Okay, members and visitors and guests and testifiers, we're going to get started here. My ploy apparently worked. I want to congratulate the committee. I think this is the quickest we got the quorum all session.
So, marketing.
Yeah, marketing works. So if I am privileged and honored to do this role again next year, I know what I need to do. So you all have to hold me to it. I want to thank everyone for being here today. We had an interesting night, and it's going to still be apparently an interesting day throughout the state with weather. So I really appreciate the efforts the members made to be here. I will work super hard to get us out of here by noon because I do have a noon meeting over at the Capitol. And so for all our testifiers there, what that means is that we're gonna greatly appreciate conciseness, but please do not take our desire to be out of here by noon. It's disinterest in your issues. These are very important issues, and we're not going to move any of the bills that are before us here today, largely because we're past our deadline. But what we wanted to do is hear some testifiers on three bills that are sufficient interest for this committee that may lead to either interim action or action in the next session, assuming that all of us are back here after the fall election. And that way we're fully informed. We're also going to hear from the department on the grad test, the grad exam, which this year will be adding the language arts component to that. And that'll be happening for this year's diploma. And so, a number of members have had some anxieties about the grad exam. And so it's a great opportunity to interact with the department to have them give us an update. So with that, I'm going to get started. Before I do, because I won't forget, I want to acknowledge our wonderful page, Emily. She's been with us all year. You've been terrific. We're going to miss you. Just as we'll miss each other for not being on this committee for the next several months, but we are going to miss you, and we wish you well, and hope that you continue to stay in close contact with us. So thank you for your service. Our other page is Matt, and he came up to me on the House floor last night, late at night, and he said, "I took tomorrow off." But just to show you how committed he says, "But I'll come in. I'll come in and help out. I understand it's the last meeting." I said, "Matt, 3-day weekends are rare and wonderful, and plus tomorrow's going to be a crappy day. So sleep in, stay in." And so he wisely took my advice, and we'll be also thanking Matt at a later date sometime. All right, so as I said, we're going to hear testimony from three bills, and the first of those bills is by Representative Demmer. And Representative Demmer, I'm just going to let you take off, and you can introduce your testifiers and tell us about the Baldrige Awards. There was a time in this legislature, Representative Erickson remembers this, in the 90s, when we paid close attention to these things and looked at the applicability of this private sector, really, creative, awards and high quality evaluative structure. And we're looking at, how do we increasingly try to apply that to public education. So it's good to be able to circle back after many years to see, what the state of public education and the Baldrige Award system is at. So, Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair members. I'm excited about the opportunity to present this, and I really want to express my appreciation for hearing this. It kind of came late in session. I know it has to do with financing and that sort of thing, but I think it's this is big picture stuff. And I think it's important that we look at this when we talk about Baldrige criteria and also the Minnesota Quality Council. This is about something that's being done in the private sector with companies, especially larger companies that look at trying to what we call align the arrows, get them all pointed in the same direction to make sure they're working toward achievement of whatever their goals are. And I think sometimes in education, as we work on this, we get kind of caught up in the minutiae and sometimes don't get a chance to go back from 50,000 feet and look at what are we doing to promote overall quality in our school and our education system. And I think that's what this is, this bill and the vision of the testifiers that are here for you today have. And so I'm going to, bottom line, what this is about incenting schools to and helping reimburse them for getting involved in this quality, police quality initiative. And also, once you get involved and achieve high levels, which is very, very difficult, to go out and utilize what they've learned and what they've seen from their quality initiatives. So with that, members, I'm going to not talk anymore and allow my testifiers to take over and tell you about their vision and what they see as what we can do for our school district.
Wonderful. Welcome to the committee. Good morning. And whoever wishes to start, just please state your name for the record and give us your thoughts.
Okay. Good morning. Thank you, Chairman and committee and visitors in the audience. I'm Merlin Rickliffe from Rochester, Minnesota. It really is a pleasure for me to be here today. For me, this is an extremely long journey that I have been on, so it's exciting. The concept initiated in my mind in 1993. But I think today the time is really more ripe than it ever has been. Today we have some extremely highly respected organizations and processes in place that we can build on, and you'll hear more about that this morning. We also, and maybe most importantly, we have school districts across the state of Minnesota which are both knowledgeable, understanding, and excited about the topic we're talking about here this morning. My background is 31 years with IBM in New York and Rochester, Minnesota, in research, new product development, and my last assignment was system-wide performance improvement, having a leadership role in IBM Rochester, winning the 1990 Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award. From there, I now have 17 years of experience in education as an independent international consultant and educator, starting as the 3M McKnight Distinguished Visiting Professor at the University of Minnesota in Duluth, and since then, guest lecturing or teaching at Gustavus, St. Mary's, St. Thomas, and other universities across the nation, and since 1995, teaching and lecturing at Chulalongkorn Longkorn University in Bangkok, one of the most prestigious universities in Asia, and since 2002, working with the China Center at the University of Minnesota and Sun Yat-sen University in Guangzhou, China. My experience with this process began with the IBM IBM process for pursuing the Baldrige Award in the late 1980s. I have since worked at a national level in adapting that process to education, and Brian will be talking more about that later this morning. And I probably was the first or one of the first in the nation to adapt the process to the classroom in an accredited class at UMD, as well as working with that university in incorporating the process into their management system or leadership system, as they prefer to think of it in a college or university, where they have won the highest level of academic recognition in the state of Minnesota at that time, which was 2001. We've also worked with organizations like the Ministry of Commerce in Thailand, helped them understand this process that we're presenting to you here today, and in 2002 they announced the Thai National Quality Award based upon that knowledge and that work. Now, my wife is here with me as well, Karen Wickler. We work together as a team. Karen's background is a mathematics high school teacher. She has served three terms as school board member in the Rochester School District, as well as president of the school board. Served on several state, local, and national educational committees. She's been my translator in taking my business insight and transforming it into a language where I hopefully have been effective in communicating to educators. So why are we now interested in bringing this to you today? Part of it is coming from a global perspective. And let me share with you that as good as we think we are with what we do, and it is good, the gap between us and the developing nations of the world is closing rapidly. Probably more rapidly than most people, and I can honestly say within this country, realize. If I were to draw the analogy of an airplane rolling down the runway, folks, we are approaching the end of the runway, and we've still got our wheels on the ground. that's the picture I would like to plant in your mind. The sense of urgency is great, and I'm coming from a global perspective. My most recent presentation was to the Rochester senior administrators at the invitation of Superintendent Dahlman. My topic was a rapidly changing Asia. Why is it important for us to know that now? And the reason is, as one looks ahead, those kindergarten students that are entering our classrooms this fall will be the leaders of this nation in 2050. Those who spend time working on it and thinking about it project that China will be the number one economy in 2050. We will be number two. India will be close behind. You don't see Japan, Germany, or many of our other close alliances on that list. Also, those who project technology project that for $1,000, each of us will be able to have a computer on our desk that will have the ability to replicate all of the human minds in the world at that point in time. Also at that point, there will be somewhere like 10 billion people on this planet compared to the 6.6 that are there today. This world can't sustain 10 billion people with a lifestyle as we know it, nor the lifestyle that the developing world is trying to achieve. The question I pose is, are we providing the education our children need to be able to be the leaders of that kind of world? Now, how does this process help us get there? Well, number one, I understand that this legislative session is moving along rapidly. And I understand we have a budget shortfall. I also understand that most of the discussions are of the form of reconciliation of how do we live with what we've got and cut back on what we'd like to have. But one of the primary features of what we're presenting today in this bill is leverage. Now, Archimedes, 2,300 years ago, developed the theories of a lever. It made the statement that if he could find a place to stand, had a long enough lever, he could move the earth. But with what's in this bill, with a modest amount of money, we have leverage. And you'll learn more about that in a few moments. Tremendous leverage. Utilizing institutions, organizations, processes, and achievements that are currently in place. The second point is, this bill will provide both an incentive and a modest amount of resource for school districts across this entire state to be able to write down their story of who they are, what they do, what they're trying to achieve, how well they're doing it, and determine what they're doing well, what they're not doing as well as they could, and where are the opportunities to improve, and more importantly, learn about a process that will give them the discipline by which they can improve. The third element within this proposal that I think is unique is that it provides the funding to motivate and allow those K-12 districts that are recognized as being our best within the state of Minnesota, the resources to tell their story. Tell their story to everyone within the state, most importantly, other K-12 districts. I don't have the copy in my hands at this moment, but the document that was written by the Rochester School District allowed them to achieve the third highest level offered by the Minnesota Council for Quality. If we'd have had that program 2 years ago, I would have copies here. You would have already had copies of that in your hands for you all to read. Every school district within the state of Minnesota could have had that document which describes how the Rochester system was able to do what they do. Now, there's unique only in the sense they were the first. Every district has the opportunity to become one of the best and the opportunity to then tell their story to others. And I think we've all had the experience. We often learn best when we're listening to our peers who have been there, done that, let me show you how to do it. With that, I would like to solicit any questions at the end of this session and turn it over at this moment to my colleague, Brian Lester.
Good morning.
Mr. Lassiter, good morning. Welcome to the committee. And we do have three other items we're going to need to get to, so we're going to have to be really concise and brief here. But welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep my comments 5 minutes or less.
Thank you.
I am executive director of the Minnesota Council for Quality, but these days I'd rather be in California or Hawaii calling you. Thank you, committee, for giving us the hearing this morning. I am president of the Minnesota Council for Quality. I've been in this position since 2001. I'm also a volunteer examiner with the Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award for the last 11 years. I'm joined by Lynn Willenbring, who is vice chair of our board. She's currently an employee with the City of Minneapolis, formerly an employee with the State of Minnesota. Minnesota Council for Quality was founded in 1987 by legislative action and spun off into a 501c3 2 years later. Our mission is to help organizations around the state improve their performance and reach higher levels of excellence. We're membership-based. We have nearly 300 members representing about 150,000 employees in and beyond Minnesota. The Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award was also created in 1987 by an act of Congress with the purpose of helping U.S. businesses improve their performance and competitiveness. The framework, as Merlin described, was used heavily by manufacturers in the late 80s and early 90s, quickly was adopted by the service sector, and though businesses still represent the majority of users, the last 5 to 10 years, a growing number of non-businesses are using the framework. Healthcare providers, governmental agencies, nonprofit agencies, K-12 school districts, and higher ed institutions. Baldrige is really about six things. It's about helping leaders identify strengths and improvement opportunities, about facilitating organizational improvement, alignment, and integration, about assisting in the delivery of value to stakeholders by focusing on outcomes, measures, and results, by facilitating organizational and personal learning, and helping leaders to monitor progress over time. So the recognition through the award is important. It's very secondary to the learning and improvement that takes place and the accountability that takes place by using the framework. Baldrige is a framework. It's a management system, a leadership system, as Merlin describes it, that comprises of six process categories and one comprehensive results category. They include leadership, strategic planning, student and stakeholder focus, measurement analysis and knowledge management, workforce focus, process management, and in the results category includes student achievement, student stakeholder results, financial marketplace related results, workforce results, process results, and leadership outcomes. Underneath these seven categories are a series of validated criteria called the Criteria for Performance Excellence. And you all have in your packets a red book that outlines these criteria for performance excellence. The criteria are changed every 2 years by the Baldrige program, and they are changed by studying organizations that have demonstrated high performance results, outcomes, figuring out what those organizations are doing, and then incorporating those best practices into future years' criteria. They have become a collection of empirical best practices that other organizations can gauge their performance against. Organizations that are using the Baldrige framework typically conduct an assessment of their performance against these criteria. In our Minnesota Quality Award process, we have a trained volunteer board of evaluators of over 100 leaders and professionals from all over the state. They conduct evaluations in four phases, a four-phase process: an independent review, consensus, site visits, and the final step is an improvement planning session with senior leaders of the organization that helps leaders identify and then prioritize improvement opportunities such that they can optimize their resources and allocate resources towards improvement. Most organizations use this process as input into their planning process so they can prioritize resources and allocate appropriately. There's plenty of evidence of the improved value to organizations, K-12 organizations that are using this framework. There have been four National Quality Award recipients from K-12, Pearl River School District in New York, Chugach Schools in Alaska, Community Consolidated School District 15 in Palatine, Illinois, and the Jenks Public Schools in Jenks, Oklahoma. There have also been three higher ed institutions receive the award, one down the road in Wisconsin, UW-Stout. I'll leave you a copy of my transcript that outlines several indicators of the high performance that these organizations achieve in the dimensions of student achievement, student stakeholder satisfaction, workforce satisfaction, and financial and budgetary performance. My final thought relates to the use of Baldrige in the state of Minnesota. There have been 97 recipients of our Baldrige-based Minnesota Quality Award since our first award was given in 1991. Businesses are still using the framework, as I mentioned earlier, but a growing number of healthcare providers, governmental agencies, nonprofits, and K-12 districts are also using the framework. In fact, next year, we will recognize 9 Minnesota organizations for achieving the 2007 Minnesota Quality Award. 4 of the 9 are K-12 school districts from around the state. We estimate there are at least 20 to 25 school districts across Minnesota already using Baldrige and seeing the value of the framework and improving their academic outcomes and their non-academic results. We're going to hear from two superintendents of schools that will testify to the value of this framework for their district. We would have heard from a third one. Quint Willard, superintendent of Marshall Public Schools, was stuck in the snow and could not make it today. With that, I'll hold my comments too, or my questions, until the end. I'd like to introduce first Deb Bowers, superintendent of schools for St. Louis Park School District.
Welcome, Superintendent Bowers.
Good morning. Thank you very much for allowing me to be here. I'm superintendent of the St. Louis Park School District, but I also am a Minnesota quality judge. And I've been on a quality journey since I've been principal in the Robbinsdale School District probably almost 15 years ago. And the reason that I support the framework is because I believe it assists school districts in answering the question, how are you doing and how do you know? When we talk about it in St. Louis Park, you'll hear us talk about continuous improvement. A few people will talk about Baldrige, but not very many. Because it's really about what are those drivers, that driver triad, when you look at what does your leadership look like, what is your strategic plan. But it's all about results and accountability. Because we have to be more efficient. And too often in public education, we, in the Plan, Do, Study, Act, we spend a lot of time planning and doing. And we go back and forth very quickly. But we don't spend a lot of time in saying, well, is what we're doing getting the results that we want? If yes, continue, and how do we replicate that? And if no, what are we going to do differently? And that's what this framework really assists us with, and not only just as QCOMP helps us with helping with improving teacher performance and student achievement. This helps the entire organization to look at their efficiency and their effectiveness. So very briefly, I support this as an initiative to help other school districts get started. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Keith Dixon. I'm Superintendent of Schools in Duluth. And again, thank you for listening this morning. I also have been on this journey on quality for over 15 years now. I'm also called a Baldrige judge and also go on visits to help other organizations, both public and private. And I also serve on the Minnesota Council for Quality for our state. I think, first of all, what I want you to hear in my brief minutes would be similar to some messages you're now hearing. Certainly, it would be great to win the Baldrige Award, but in a way, for me, that's really secondary to what this is really about. Because bottom line, as Deb said too, it's really about getting results. And so what we're really interested in, and if you look at the districts that have embraced the Baldrige framework and using quality practice, whether it's in the state of Minnesota or nationally, what we see is those districts are, in fact, getting higher levels of achievement and, just as importantly, closing the achievement gap. And I think another major outcome is the effective and efficient use of resources and trying to do everything we can to reduce the out-of-class room resources that we have. And I think the process of Baldrige helps an organization determine how to do that. And I'll give you one simple example just to give a flavor of how this works. When I got to Duluth, we started just to look at the process of purchase orders and how many people are involved in our organization in processing a purchase order to conclusion. And we estimated the amount of time a purchase order took, and then we also estimated then, as a result of that, what it really cost us to process a purchase order. And we found that in most cases, in the majority of our purchase orders that were submitted, it actually cost us more to process the purchase order than the purchase order was actually worth. And so, you know, that's not good business. Okay, so we changed our whole process in terms of how purchase orders were done in our district. We increased the limit that individuals had where you didn't have to go through the purchase order process, as an example. Those are all efficiencies that come with this out of the classroom. I think that just as importantly, it does help us become data-driven. It does help us build relationships with our staff because fundamentally, as you learn in this process, most of the issues we deal with are not people issues, but rather process and systems issues. And so it helps define that I think, in a really meaningful way to help move the district forward. And I think, ultimately, too, bottom line, what it also does is change the roles and responsibilities in a school district clear to the classroom level of how the teacher and the students interact with each other. So for us in Duluth right now, certainly we've started our quality journey there. One of the things we're doing right now is insightful, and you've got your books in front of you. One of the first things is really to really define the, really your customer requirements. What is it that our community would like us to deliver? What do they want from for us to do so that when students leave our district there, what do they want them to know and be able to do? And so we're in a really great conversation in Duluth right now. We call it our process of promise. What are we going to promise our young people that when they leave our system, what's that going to be about? And it's an exciting journey to define that and start to think about how we're going to measure that. As Brian said, how we're going to report those results back to our community on an ongoing basis. We're starting to talk about how we align our work then, not only from the district level, but to the school and to the classroom. And we're also now created a quality council in Duluth. And every month now, all of our 11 unions in Duluth meet with myself and members of my leadership team and a board member from our Board of Education. And we're sitting down together now and talking about how to improve our school system together and work together more effectively and efficiently. Those are the kind of outcomes, I think, that come from these kinds of processes and systems. So Baldrige is simply a framework. It's a way to help us align our work, to have a conversation together about how to improve schools, how to improve relationships, how to really create a better bond between schools and the community. So I do support this process of simply helping to figure out a way to encourage more school districts to get involved on an ongoing basis. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent. And on that note, given whatever constraints we currently have, and perhaps also given that the state is not actively involved, as it seems to me, anymore in terms of promoting activities related to the Quality Council, what do you all do in terms, if you're able to do anything, in terms of being able to share your learnings with other school districts across the state? And either one can...
Great question. I think relative to this piece, certainly what you're talking about is how do we share quality practice with each other. And there's a variety of ways to do that. Certainly now on our agenda, when we put an agenda together where we meet really almost four times a year as superintendents in the state, we do have sessions on quality practice, the Baldrige framework, how we're moving forward on these. In fact, just a week ago, I did one at our kind of, I don't call this winter or midwinter conference, simply on using this process as a process to create a community conversation about how to reduce the number of schools. We had to go through that in Duluth. And so we used this Baldrige framework as a process, a model to do that. And so I gave that presentation to a room full of superintendents. So we're engaged at those kinds of levels. And I think the other exciting thing, we're also engaged with public and private partners. It's just not us. So in Duluth right now, we've also created a community, as Rochester has done, Quality Council, that has members from our hospitals, from our major businesses there, public-private sector along with us. And so that meeting and sharing ideas together has really been a powerful way to help us along with the other businesses in the community. That changes our relationship with the businesses in our community.
I would say that we're not as far as Juan's, because what we're first doing it is sharing it across to our other schools. So it's really a district initiative. We have one of our schools that has about 50% free and reduced lunch, and that school has demonstrated significant results in the last 3 years, in which the number of African-American students in grade 3 scoring on the math test at about 3 years ago had 30% proficiency. Last year they had 80%. And while that I know that the MCA tests have changed, that is still that we have been able to demonstrate significant improvement results because of working not only using the framework assist you, but we have other initiatives that work as well, professional development with staff, using some behavior pre-referral incidents. So we've got many components, but this helps you to put the full package together. So what we're looking at is results for students.
Thank you. And Superintendent Bowers will have to visit on this, on those achievement gap issues. I would look forward to that conversation.
Thank you.
Mr. Lasseter.
If I may, Mr. Chair, thank you. There is a consortium, you may be aware, on the committee, 13 school districts in southeast Minnesota that all voluntarily belong to the Rochester Area Math and Science Partnership. This is a consortium supported by IBM and Mayo and higher ed in the area. Their primary focus is improving math, science, technology achievement of their students. But they have begun using the Baldrige framework as a management system to also improve all student outcomes. They're now requiring each district in this consortium to go through a Baldrige-based assessment every 3 years. And in so doing, they're not only performing improving their individual school district's performance, but they have a common language, a common framework to benchmark and share best practices across the 13 districts. That's one example of a model in the state of sharing within school districts.
Wonderful. We do have a question from Representative Graham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, not so much of a question as a comment. Yesterday, we in K-12 finance, we heard our education finance reform proposal, and I think it's very serendipitous that we now have this this proposal in front of us today, because I hope you'll track that, and I know Representative Demmer is on K-12 finance, so he will track it. We're starting out a new innovation revenue, and this is exactly the sort of thing that we have in mind. We mentioned the University of Minnesota and growth and justice, and now we will add the Baldrige, because we want districts based on a school report card that shows value-added growth. If their students are making value-added growth, they get the innovation revenue, and they can be the best practices to share with other districts. And if they're not, and it could be Edina or it could be inner city Minneapolis that either are making it or aren't making it because it's based on where did your kids start, then they have to get an approved plan by the Commissioner of Education as to how are they going to spend their innovation revenue to make sure their kids are making value-added growth. So, and then we also have continue to have the staff development set aside. And so both of those funds, hopefully, you will be marketing strongly. And we are proud that in the education finance reform bill, these are opportunities for all districts. You know, we always get things started with pilots and grants, but we have a strong preference for all districts being able to participate, because we find that when it's grants, you know, like QCOMP is a good example, it tends to be the districts that have enough staff to do the application, and then there's a, you know, lesser participation sometimes from the smaller rural districts. And that gets to be a rub here. So, but you plug in very nicely with what we're doing, and I hope you'll track our language so that it works for you.
Thank you, Representative Growley. I think it's a great invitation, and I agree there is an element of serendipity here that we're having this discussion subsequent to that one, and I'm seeing nods of the heads from people on the table, so I think we got some willing engagers here as we move forward with those reform efforts. Representative Benson, Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to ask a question or two of our first presenter, if we could. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I did not pick up the gentleman's name.
Perhaps Mr. Rickliff?
Mr. Rickliff.
Or perhaps Dr. Rickliff. Is that,
you did very well.
Oh, okay, very well.
Dr. Rickliff, I was listening to your testimony, and one of the questions I had was concerned with your discussion of what's happening in South Asia and East Asia with a number of these countries, China and India, I suppose, principally. And I'm just wondering if you could give us a little outline of the kinds of investment in education that these countries are making in relation to their old gross national product or the priority that they have established for themselves in relationship to what has traditionally been the case here in the United States, for example. And then maybe a little follow-up on that. What do you see is the effect of, or the role of culture, the attitude towards education, those kinds of things, with a number of these South Asian countries?
That's correct, Les. If you could do that briefly, although I suspect we could spend many hours on that particular topic, and perhaps we should in some future days, but Dr. Rickles.
Okay, I appreciate the question. Let me start in reverse order from a cultural point of view. What we see in Asia, to me, parallels a lot of what I saw in my youth, and that is hardworking people looking for greater opportunities, and they see education as the vehicle to get there. The pressures sometimes are what we might consider exorbitant, but I had a fair amount of pressure when I was a kid, too, to study. There was not too much horsing around. I would say the culture is a very significant factor in these countries. Also, their ability to encourage multiple languages within their schools, in particular learning English. I don't know how many of you are aware, there are more English-speaking people in China than there are English-speaking people in the United States. Tells me, I think we should be learning how to speak Mandarin Chinese. In terms of being able to address the amount of resource which they're applying to it, I'm afraid I can't do that. But in terms of how I'm looking at gross domestic product, I do have those numbers fairly well in my head. We as a nation produce approximately $43,500 of gross domestic product per person. Those are our goods and services. In China, it's less than 2,000. India, it's less than 1,000. And you can go all the way on down to Myanmar, and it's kind of like $250, $60 per person. Now, those people recognize the way they're going to get their GDP, which also reflects their consumption, up to a level and a lifestyle like ours, means it's education. Another observation, particularly within the Thai schools, where I've spent more time working with students. In China, I'm working primarily with senior executives. Three-fourths of the students in my classes in Thailand are women. Culturally, that's somewhat culturally driven, in that the men within the family anticipate they will inherit the family wealth. The women know they're not going to. They know their route to success is through education. They're the top students in our class. Now, the interesting twist on that, though, as the families are getting smaller, there's often not a son in the family. So these young women not only have the motivation to go through higher education, learn, and study, they're also likely to be inheriting the business in what was formerly the older son's responsibility. So we'll be seeing those cultural-driven changes as we move ahead in the future. But my analogy before is from a nation. Our advantage yet today is our level, our educational capabilities, our educated workforce, our innovative minds, but let me tell you, they are catching up rapidly. And therefore, we truly are on this airplane that's coming to the end of the runway, and our wheels are still on the ground.
Members, we're going to need to move on. We do have two other bills. I know you had a follow-up, and I understand Representative Wardlaw and Benson, or rather Bentner, also had a question, but I'm going to exercise this moving forward and apologize to you. But Representative Demmer, I would look forward to continuing this conversation from a couple of vantage points, and certainly one is the invitation from Representative Greiling, think about ways in which, you know, this community and this initiative and this perspective can be part of any kind of future reforms as we move forward. And that's been going to be an ongoing discussion, not only in this, what remains in this session, but I suspect also throughout the interim and hopefully into the next session. Perhaps you can just do a quick sum up and then we'll move forward. But thank you, Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think as we all think about the reason that we are here because we care about our state, and we serve on this committee and in this area because we care about kids, we care about education, every single one of us. The thing I like about this, I think this gives us a chance to not talk so much about where we want to go. We know we want world-class education, and we deal with that every single day as individuals, as legislators, as people interested in education. This gives us a framework to be on this journey, and I think a way for us to, if you will, get a roadmap. And we've got individual segments along the way. We'll talk about individual initiatives and things that we have. This is a framework for kind of putting the whole thing together, and I think it's got some real promise, and it's in the private sector, it's in the public sector, it makes some good sense. So it's big picture. I think it makes a lot of sense, and I think it's something that we can continue to work with, and I really appreciate the time to present this and have the presenters give their vision of education, and so I look forward to working on it ongoing. But thank you again for the opportunity, and thanks for letting us go first. And like I said, I
appreciate your leadership on this, Representative Demmer and Representative Bowers, Dixon, Mr. Lasser, Dr. Rickless, and Mrs. Rickless. Thank you for being with us here today. With that, I am going to jump around the agenda a little bit. I'm seeing Representative Simon in the back. I'm going to have Representative Simon come forward with the driver education, online driver education issue. Members, we heard this issue last session, but not in this committee. It was vetted, I think, primarily through the Transportation Committee, which is an appropriate place for it to be vetted. But there were a number of concerns that the members here in the committee had raised, and so we had asked the author of the bill if he could just sort of slow that down and make sure that we had an opportunity at some point for Education Committee members to talk about this. And so there was not a strong desire to attempt to push forward with last year's bill this year because the author of the bill and the proponents wanted to make sure that there was enough comfort here among different groups. And so there wasn't a big push this year, but certainly this was an opportunity to look at this issue a little bit more carefully. So Representative Simon, welcome
to the
committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate you coming in on a Friday morning after a late night. And thank you particularly, Mr. Chair, for allowing this hearing on the show. We're very grateful for that. Members, this is a bill that would give Minnesota families one more option when it comes to driver's education. Right now, as you may know through your own experience or through the experience of your children or other people that you know, kids in Minnesota, primarily, who are seeking to get their driver's permit, the permit only, have a couple options. Many take it through their school. Some, like happened with me, take it at some non-school place. I happen to take it through AAA, which is right near my house, so it was more convenient. And this would allow students in Minnesota to have what just about half of the United States now has, including states like Texas, Pennsylvania, California, Colorado, Virginia, and several others have, which is the option, only the option. It's one item on the menu, the option of taking only the permit portion of the test, not the behind the wheel. You can't substitute, you know, online learning for actually getting behind the wheel, just the permit test. You could, if you wanted to, only an option, no cost to the state, you could take it on a certified online driver's ed course. That's it. It's a menu option. It's giving families and students that option. Now, would I have my kid do this? Maybe, maybe not. I'm not sure. Would you? Maybe, maybe not. But the point is that for a lot of families, including homeschool families, including folks in rural areas where it's really an inconvenience to drive a long distance to be able to go where a student can get driver's education, this is a realistic option. And the one thing that I just want to point out, members, is we had an excellent presentation when we had this before, and Chair Mariana, you're right, this passed nearly unanimously through Representative Hornstein's Committee on Transportation Policy. Then it went to the full committee, Representative Leaders Committee, passed nearly unanimously, where you had people all over the political spectrum, both political parties supporting it. Then it went to Finance, and it was referred here. And obviously, because this is an informational hearing only, it won't be actually enacted this year. But we do have language right now in Representative Hornstein's Transportation Omnibus Policy Bill that directs the Department of Public Safety to do kind of a survey, an overview of the literature out there on the safety of online driver ed. And I think the real comfort here, members, is the backstop, the insurance policy, if you will, is the permit test. Obviously, you can't go and get your license unless you pass the permit. So if any course, be it an online driver's ed course, taking it at AAA or private academy, or taking it at school, if
it bad or if the student does badly at it, there's a backstop there. That is, they're going to fail the permit test. It's an objective test. And you may remember taking it yourself. I do. I remember going into the driver's bureau in the office and taking it and being nervous and all the rest. But if you don't pass the test, you don't pass the test. It's not as if students in any of the circumstances I named, including the ones that exist in current law, it's not as if they're able to be sort of passed along somewhere after having received some sort of substandard education. They won't. The backstop is the test. If you fail the test, you can't move on. And so this is just one more option. Again, it's only a permit. For the permit, it's only an option. And we think it's just a useful option for folks. Before I hand it over to Rob Layton, I just want to talk a little bit, and I'm not going to read it. You can read it yourself. The handout here that starts with the online driver safety education that you all should have. Is that King Pat? Okay. Great. So the one thing I wanted to point out is, and you can read for yourself, but the one thing that we found interesting is a letter of support here. There's sort of a summary, and you're going to see a brief PowerPoint. But the one thing, and I want to be respectful about this, but I think this is instructive. If you look on page 2 of the handout, it shows that currently at MinSU campuses, and here's the ad for it right here, you can learn how to be a driver's ed instructor online. That you can do. That we already do. And you can't make this stuff up. It's okay right now at our own public colleges and universities to learn how to teach driver's ed and learn how to teach it online. That's okay. But, you know, we're debating this issue as we should, and I don't want to be too cute about it. I just mean that there's been some real... I'm not going to kick you here, and some of you have heard about it last year, some really angry, I would even say hostile, responses to this proposal by some people. And I'm sure I know that they're all well-intentioned, but I think those who are very, really angry about this proposal need to just think about this for a second. It's only an option. It's a menu item. You may not choose it for your kids, but it's an option that's worked well in half the United States, and we already tell people teaching our kids that they can learn how to teach this very material to our kids online. So I want to allay people's fears, and I don't want to dismiss the concerns. You all hear about them from those who oppose this for good reasons, or for what they believe are good reasons, but I just think we need to take a step back, and there was some real anger here when it still came forward, and that's why, Mr. Chairman, we're particularly appreciative. So without anything further, I just want to hand it over to Rob Layton to expand on that, and then we'll see a brief presentation. I know time is of the essence.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Layton, a former colleague and a good friend. It's always good to see you. We had a chance to visit on this a few months ago, and I have to say that I was certainly in the community, and I saw questions. I was certainly in the community of individuals that had concern, but I have to say, that, and I'd like to attribute it to our friendship, but it had nothing to do with that, I had a number of questions that were comfortably answered for me, and so I look forward to your testimony here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the chance to be here. Representative Simon does such a great job. He leaves little for me to focus on, and I know your time is critical, so I'll move very quickly. I'm here. I'm Rob Layton. I'm a lawyer with Nolan McGregor Thompson and Layton in St. Paul. I actually live in Representative Wardlow's district in Eagan. But I'm here on behalf of...
Sorry, Representative Wardlow.
I'm here on behalf of a company called DriversEd.com. They're based in Oakland, California, and they are the leader in the country at providing online driver's education. And that's why they have an interest in permitting this here in Minnesota. They're currently permitted to do this in 11 states, but as Representative Simon said, it's about half the country when you look at the population because it's some of the largest states in the country, and this is something that consumers love, and it's working very, very well, and we would just hope that we can answer your questions and you'd look at how it's working that we consider this next year when we move forward. In each state, and this is very important for you to understand, in every state this works, there is state regulation of this online service, whether it's the Department of Motor Vehicles or the Department of Public Safety, which is the way it would be done here in Minnesota. It would be overseen and regulated by the department. And we want that. We want tight, strong regulation. It should be highly regulated. You need to know that a company like DriversEd.com is not some fly-by-night outfit working out of some basement somewhere. We don't know where it is. It is a family-run business that for more than 20 years ran a traditional classroom driver's education school in California. It was founded by Isaac Ziffrin and his son Gary Ziffrin. They, after running the traditional classes, launched their first internet course in 1998, about 10 years ago. And they're really the pioneer in this area. They now have over 75 employees and they provide services throughout the country. We were hoping, for your sake, that we would have Gary Ziffrin here today to do the presentation because he can show you exactly how it works and answer your questions. I know that Representative Hornstein had the opportunity last session in the Transportation Committee to hear that testimony, and I think you found it helpful. I think the committee found it very helpful. Unfortunately, he had a major health problem last week, and he's been ordered by his doctors that he can't fly. So he missed this presentation, and I apologize for that. But we do have Debbie Prudholm here, who's going to run through quickly through the PowerPoint presentation. Ms. Prudholm is a Minnesota resident that's been a longtime owner and operator of the traditional driver's education, and she is now a strong proponent of this type of technology. I just want to focus very quickly on three points where there's been some confusion, and Representative Simon addressed the first one. The use of this technology has nothing to do with the behind-the-wheel training that students need and they're going to continue to get. And in fact, this year, skills were introduced that would have extended the hours. I think right now you need 6 hours of behind-the-wheel. There were bills that would have mandated more. This has nothing to do with that. And I know there's been confusion by legislators on that. I just want to make that crystal clear. All this would be is an option for students. Some parents may teach traditional classroom and others may not. I can tell you that the more I've spoken to people about this, including legislators, who have children in this age group that are doing after-school activities, sports, there's scheduled virtually no time, they told us this would be a tremendous option if my son or daughter could utilize this technology at home on a Sunday afternoon when they have some time available. I do think consumers like it, and that's been proven in other states. My second point is that it appears that the opposition to this technology seems to come from individuals who benefit from the status quo. That seems to be, Representative Simon referenced, there seems to be an anger or something about this, and they may have valid concerns. My only point would be, if there are concerns, and the concern that we heard over and over last year was safety, that somehow if you utilize this technology, kids will not know the rules of the road, and they're going to be crashing their car. I mean, literally, those were some of the arguments we heard. There may be valid concerns. We want that addressed. All we ask is that we actually look at the research and the studies that are out there that have looked at this issue. Because there are studies that have looked at this. We don't believe that those arguments are valid. We don't think safety is a concern. But you certainly don't have to take our word for it. I don't expect you to. Which is why in Representative Hornstein's omnibus transportation policy bill that was the 07 bill that's now moving this year, we have specific language in there that's going to mandate that the Department of Public Safety issue a report to the legislature next session in February that will, and I want to just so you know what's being required, they have to review and analyze all current findings and studies on the feasibility, effectiveness, and impact of internet-based driver education programs, including the effectiveness for persons under age 18. So they're going to collect that data, they're going to report back to the Transportation Committee next year, and I think that's important. And I hope that we'll look at that and make an objective decision. My last point is that it's extremely important for you to realize this is not a situation where one internet company can create one driver's ed program online, and that's the program for 10 or 20 or 30 states. It's not the way it works. Just like now, the curriculum has to be developed specifically for that state or that jurisdiction, specific to the rules in Minnesota. And it's going to be regulated by the Department of Public Safety. And if they don't meet the criteria set up by the department, no online service provider is going to be able to provide this in Minnesota. And that's the way it should be. So we have faith in the department. They've done a great job in the past. We believe they'll be able to do a great job on this. and we think it's something that we hope the legislature will consider. And with that, I will turn it over to Jen.
While she comes up, I'm going to ask Chair Hornstein, assuming we're successful with the 07 policy bill, there's some other issues there. It would be, and actually I'm hopeful that we, I'm optimistic that we will be, but it would be good at such point at which that report is available and that could be shared with this committee so that we can also then share it with members. And I think that Representative Simon is, and again, who knows if any of us will be back here at the elections, but it would be my interest to be able to vet whatever bill comes forward through this process. When you have my word, we'll do a fair and balanced review of that. Ms. Prudholm, welcome. And again, I am pressed for time. That seems to be a perennial thing that hangs over this committee, but I look forward to your testimony. Please state your name for the record. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Debbie Prudholm, and I will be, I'll try to be very brief and not repeat points. I first want to say thank you very much for hearing this bill in this environment where we have an opportunity to really weigh the issues, and it is important to consider all the issues, and so it's important to hear all people's input. As was mentioned, I own a large driving school here in Minnesota, and I've been teaching and developing some of Minnesota's most progressive programming in the metro area and in outstate for 12 years, and I've literally taught thousands of kids to drive. My most recent success story was an Indian nun. That was fantastic.
I want to hear that story.
I'm very familiar with driver education and traffic safety initiatives, both in Minnesota and as well as in the nation. I'm an active member of our national association, and I'm going to Washington May 7th to attend as an invited participant with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration's project to develop national standards for driver education. I also would like to let you know that I met the owners of DriversEd.com at our national convention, and at the time that I met them, I was very, very, very opposed to online training methods. And once I was able to open my mind, go out and investigate, take a few programs, learn more about who was offering those programs, I recognized some distinct differences, and now I find myself in a very different position actually advocating for these programs. And Representative Simon and Rob have made some very excellent points, and what I'd like to do is just go through some background, hopefully dispel some myths, and just mention the research. Say a couple things about curriculum, distance learning features, administration, security, and the benefits. You know, Minnesota already allows correspondence learning and distance learning. Online driver education classroom instruction is available for novice adults 18 years plus in Minnesota. Driver education, as Representative Simon mentioned, actually can be achieved, the instructor certification can be achieved online. And I find it very interesting that through those kinds of programs, there is very, very little hands-on teaching. In fact, through the state college program, there's only about 6 hours of actual teaching required before you get that, in the car, before you get that certification. And many book courses have been approved for correspondence, courses here for homeschool students in Minnesota. And I'd like to think that a static book certainly wouldn't be as effective as a dynamic interactive program. And many Minnesota districts are actually offering virtual high schools, and I'm sure you're aware of that. You know, a lot of people ask, is somebody going to be able to teach somebody how to drive with a computer? And the actual answer is absolutely not. You know, we have to keep in mind, and I'd like to make sure that you keep this distinction in your mind, that there's two components to all skills that we learn, theory and laboratory. And we're talking about the theory education, offering options just to achieve the theory education. You know, in the classroom right now, we do not do any driving. You know, we talk about driving for 30 hours. And so that's a very important distinction that we need to remember. And also, just to also keep in mind that 6 hours of on-road, we need more than that. I know that's a whole other topic, but we really do need that. It's really kind of almost absurd that we could actually teach somebody to drive in 6 hours. That won't happen, in my estimation. You know, a lot of people actually say, well, you know, driver's education is too important to try something new. Well, Representative Simon mentioned the number of states that are trying it. And all of these states who find very serious monitoring, the agencies, the monitoring agencies, the jurisdictional authorities can log into these programs at any time and find out what is happening online. And there's been many successful relationships with these authorities as these online programs have been developed in these states. And 120 million people are taking driver education online. And I just haven't seen some of the more of the fear-mongering types of things result, and that's 120 people. We mentioned the studies. Is classroom driver's education better than online learning? Well, there's a couple of studies out there I'd like to mention. Dr. Randy Flimmer in 2005 actually stated that online assisted driving, when properly set up, delivered, and monitored, can be equally effective in terms of student performance as compared to traditional classroom delivery models. And then the California DMV, a very, very impartial study, and that's an important point, their findings present no compelling evidence that home study courses are less effective than classroom courses for teaching driver education. I know that you probably have questions about curriculum, and we mentioned the CEO and founder of DriverZ.com. This particular curriculum does come from 25 years of experience as an owner and an operator. And I have to say that that makes you very exclusively qualified to know what is good for a teenager. We're with them, and we actually do know. We're actually on the street. And that's kind of an important point. This curriculum is based on a very long history of driver education. And I just would like to say that, you know, this isn't an internet company who found a cool niche and hired a web guy. This is actually an online course.
Ms. Prudhomme, I'm going to move you along here.
Okay, all right. The online also allows us to take driver education in many languages, and we heard from the former testifier that is very important in our environment. And this also is not just a driver's manual online. You can see all of the features here. Navigable, section reviews, very easy to update, very easy to customize. Two-dimensional, three-dimensional. It's got a lot of features that enhance learning. And I want to make a very strong point that all programs are not created equal. That the technology used is very important. Flash-driven, fully animated technology allows people to see internet video, Minnesota Life Source. I can see Life Source being on there. The trucking videos we watch, roundabout videos, intersection videos, and real driving situations, two-dimensional and three-dimensional. There's also many questions that come about how can something online be monitored. And this is a screen print of it's called the student footprint. And we can actually go in, administrators also, jurisdictional administrators, can go in and look at this student footprint and track student performance down to the minute. It also allows program developers to recognize bottlenecks and sort of, you know, go back and redesign, retool, and correct those kinds of problems. Security is always raised. How do you know the student is actually signed in and sitting at the computer? That was an important, that was my big concern, so I know how important it is to other people. And erecting obstacles to fraud is the best method. And I find myself in my own classroom erecting, you know, obstacles to fraud. And sometimes they're effective and sometimes they're not. They do this through, has anybody taken an online course? I'm participating in an online course. Currently I'm getting my master's in theology and I'm taking online courses as well as a webinar. And so if you've heard of personal validation questions, you know that they're important, that this sporadic questioning of the student is based on personal information and actually does ensure that the identity of the respondent is at the computer. There's also content validation questions that ensure that the respondent is at the computer and paying attention, that they're just not there and paying attention. I just have a really quick story. I attended a webinar, and I went to the restroom during the webinar. I came back, and I couldn't answer the question. So I know for real that it works. They also have good testing and good obstacles, and we've outlined the benefits of on-demand learning, increased motivation, better quality control, personal safety, greater flexibility, improved accountability, and other things that people said. But I would like to mention that this is a way to bring consistent education to rural areas and to remote areas, and it also allows ease of scheduling, and that this is just one more option for Minnesota families. Thank you.
Ms. Prudhomme, your passion is quite evident, and we did have an opportunity to meet in my office for an extended discussion, and you were passionate there about this issue as well, and I really appreciate the carefulness that you bring to this issue, actually as someone who was opposed originally to this, so thank you for that. There are several members who have comments and questions. Let's do that very, very quickly, members. There are some folks in the audience that are uncomfortable with this proposal. I would like to hear from them very briefly. I want to remind folks, we are not moving a bill today. We will most likely, if a bill like this is reintroduced next year, we will have an extensive hearing on this. I think it is important that we move carefully, and I suspect Representative Hornstein will also have an equivalent extensive hearing as he did this last session. So Representative Wales, Erickson, Gryling, Peterson, then we'll hear from members in the audience.
My comments are just very brief, Mr. Chair, but I just thought it was ironic as we were talking about online learning course. I work with three wonderful teachers at Woodbury High School who are classroom teachers, but they also are driver's ed teachers after school. And one of them who was looking at retirement and doing driver's ed as a way to supplement his income did an online course to get his certification through St. Cloud. And it was a comedy. Almost every day he would come in and he would just be complaining about this computerized online course and so forth and so on. And now, when he heard about this bill coming forward, he's like, you cannot let them pass that. You cannot let them pass that. So I just think that human nature is interesting at times. That's my only comment.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'll pass in consideration.
You're wonderful. Representative Gryling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not.
She's quite proud of it.
I for Mr. Strom. Could you refresh our memory, Mr. Strom, as to, I remember this used to be part of the school deal, and now it's not. And what was the deal there?
Mr. Strom. Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, Representative Gryling, I'm sorry, I don't remember on this.
First,
we'll get back to you on this, but I don't actually recall that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, what sort of prize does Representative Gryling get for something to firm?
Let's pass the hat around.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll look forward to that answer because I know we used to have it under our committee, and now we don't. And that's my concern about this, is that it's all going through the Transportation Committee, and I think that was a lot of the anger over this bill last time, as we noticed it, you know, not even coming here, and then when it did. And so I hope that, we always are looking at other committees trying to do things for us, but I think we kind of did some of this to ourselves by whatever we did that we can't remember. So I think we definitely want to see this bill again. My question for Representative Simon, I noticed the list in the PowerPoint had 10 other states listed, and they're doing this, but more than half of them did not just have the Department of Public Safety, they had the Department of Education. And we really, in this committee, think that things that are educational should involve the Education Committee and the Department of Education. And so why did you not?
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Gryling. I can't really speak to why the conscious decision was made to do one or the other. I mean, as I'm sure you acknowledge, this is sort of a hybrid issue. It's the highways, there's an educational component as well, so I guess it was a judgment call. It certainly wasn't to evade any one agency or another, but the call was made, and I don't even remember if it was too late to make. That's right. DTS already has the regulation currently as to the content of driver's ed, so it would be switching it to the Department of Education. Right now, they regulate that sort of thing. So that's the decision. But I agree. I mean, I think, obviously, we've seen an appetite here for it to go through this committee, and it should next year if it comes back, and it will. And so it certainly wasn't, you know, an intent to evade anything. What I'm hearing is already the Department of Public Safety has jurisdiction over this, at least as to the regs that are already in place.
Thank you, Representative Simon. Ms. Altschlager, if you can come forward quickly. You're sensing our urgency to move quickly. So these are individuals who have concerns about this bill. And to the testifiers, we are not moving a bill today. If this bill comes back, we will have an extensive hearing. And so it is not my intention to spend more than 3 minutes at this point on this. I have two other items on the agenda, and I want to get us through by noon. You have my word that if I am chair, again, and this comes through this committee, we will carefully listen to everyone's concerns about this issue. Ms. Altschlager.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Committee, Dan Altschlager, the chief of Minnesota, so I will just pick up the most important point. Addressing the problem of rural students. Our teachers are very supportive of ITV type of programs, but you have to have a classroom teacher in there so that you have that teachable moment and the judgment. DriversEd.com is a for-profit business. This is a moneymaker issue. What I have been so impressed with when I have talked to these Driver's Ed teachers, I have not heard one time about the concern about jobs. Not one time. They're going to lose jobs. What they're concerned about is safety. And I can just imagine these kids at the computers listening to their iPod, their cell phone, text messaging, like they do in cars. And this is not a time when teen crashes kill more teens. Car crashes kill teens more than any other way.
We have almost an epidemic in this state.
We do. And the results were released last week where our percentages are going up. And I do want to just go on record to say that the Minneapolis police and police officers are opposed to this, as is the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, although I did not get clarification that I could hand out their letter again this year, so I just want to go on record that I did get it from the chief and chief justice. I have a lot more to say, but I'll leave it at that for a few people to talk, okay?
Thank you, Ms. Altschlager. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record and give us your brief.
I will be brief.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Representative Simon and I met last year.
I'm sorry, you'll need to...
My name is William Wodarski, and I am the coordinator of Driver's Ed for the Minneapolis Public Schools.
Thank you.
I have been teaching Driver's Ed and coordinating Driver's Ed since 1969. So I think I have a little bit experience as far as knowing what to expect from the kids and what the kids need to learn about this very, very important topic of learning how to drive. The testimony that I heard before, summarizing it, basically was summarized as this is a convenience for kids and for parents. Learning how to drive should not be a convenience matter. It should be a matter of life and death, because the number one killer of kids in the state of Minnesota between the ages of 16 and 24 are automobile crashes. Our curriculum that we have goes way beyond passing the Minnesota permit test, and it also goes way beyond the curriculum from the Department of Public Safety. What we do is we teach the kids two very, very important concepts, and that is that they have got to learn proper attitude about driving and the reduction of risk when it comes to driving. I do not believe sitting on a computer the kids can learn any of these two very important concepts. For example, they can understand what the heck a sharp curve is, a warning sign, but what does he apply during his driving every day and at night and when he's home alone, or I'm sorry, when he's alone in the vehicle? It is important that a teacher be present to answer those questions immediately and to set a good tone. This is the time when we set the proper tone for learning how to drive, is during the 30 hours of classroom. It is not looking at some computer. I call the generation of teenagers that we are teaching, I call them the generation of video games. They are not going to take it seriously. I've had four of my own kids go through Driver's Ed, and now I have three of my grandkids going through Driver's Ed. And they're going to learn that it's very serious, and that if you make one little mistake, what's going to happen is it's going to kill you or it's going to kill somebody else that's around you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your brevity and preciseness. And we have one final individual, is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you. Please state your name for our record and give us your quick thoughts, sir.
Thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Larry Steinberg. I have been a secondary school teacher in the Roseville schools from 1966 to 1999, and then I taught 5 years in Minneapolis after that. And I've been teaching driver education since 1969. I have been the chair, governmental relations chair for Education Minnesota for about roughly 15 years until I retired. I just wanted to not try and say the same things as the previous speaker, but I know the last testimony that I heard on behalf of this bill made a lot of assumptions that bothered me. First of all, an online program, I don't know how long it would take to do that. I know in the classroom we have an orderly, sequential way of teaching the class. And an online, a student could rush through this program. As far as time-wise, I don't know, but I don't know. There was no stipulation. I also noticed that there was only one company that was being touted for this teaching course, and I'm asking cui bono, who benefits from this, because I didn't hear any other competition except for one firm, and I know that when I look at different things like insurance policies to purchase or products at a store, I like to look at do comparison. I don't see any comparison here. I just hear one company being touted. I also was a little upset about the fact that when Ms. Prudhomme mentioned that they have online, they can have see films on LifeSource and different experts in the field testifying. I know that for my the own courses that I teach, I have a emergency room doctor and nurses come out and speak to the kids. I have from the Burlington Northern BNSF Railroad, an expert railroad man come out and speak to the kids in person. LifeSource comes out and speaks in person. I have insurance speakers that talk to kids, and there are always questions for all these speakers, which they can't get online. And I also have a police officer who talks about, I teach in Roseville, what's happening in Roseville as far as what they're looking for, and the kids interact, and there's a plethora of questions that these students ask of these speakers, which you're not going to get online. How do you ask a speaker online? So there is something lacking there. Our material is also taught in an orderly and sequential process, and they're appropriate to help students understand the whole driving situation. I also have many students that have learning difficulties. And because I'm in the school, and I know the teachers, most of the instructors that do come in, and many of the special ed teachers will come and interact and talk to the instructor, and they can reinforce a lot of the attitudes, or the kids are having problems with worksheets or understanding in the special ed classroom, and I talk to them quite a bit, and we try and design programs that are more tailored for those students. And the main thing is the teacher has to be there to answer many specific questions. I feel a plethora of them all the time in classroom. I'm sure I have 10 or more questions each session that I do. That's probably on the low side. But the one thing is attitude, and you have to get the correct attitude for the students so they become conscientious. The maturity level of students taking driver education is from one end of the spectrum to the other, and as a teacher, I can realize this. And most of the teachers that teach drivers that have been classroom teachers. The other thing I wanted to ask you, as far as the committee, why don't we just teach social studies, math, science, all other classes in high school? Why don't we do those online? Basically, because human contact is essential, and the main thing is these students are on the road. They're going to be interacting with us. With all of us in here driving. I think you want us to have the best instruction possible. And I'll leave it at that. And thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Steinberg. It sounds like you run an excellent class. And, I took my course in 73, I think it was, maybe 74.
I was there, so but not in your district.
You might have been there with me. Thank you.
I know that the time is short, but Simon, this is my last word for the next night.
You know, Representative Simon, I am not going to have any other questions. I'm going to have you do the last word. We will most likely have a hearing on this, assuming we're all back and the bill is reintroduced. And I would welcome all the Mr. Steinberg, Mr. Rodowski, Ms. Prudhoe, I would welcome you all back at that time, and we'll have a lengthy discussion. Representative Steinberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Everything you just heard is a great argument for why you would want your kids to do a classroom course. You want your kid maybe to have a real person in there, and you don't want your kid to be distracted. Now, that's an excellent argument why that should be one of the choices. I still haven't heard the argument why this shouldn't be an option on the menu to let parents and families determine whether or not this is something that they want. You know, what we're essentially hearing here is we've got an epidemic in the state. It's the number one cause of death among teens, but let's not change a thing. Number one death among teens, let's just do what we've always been doing and not give any more options. Status quo at all costs. That's what I'm hearing. Now, the other thing I would say is I remember when I took it at AAA, and with all due respect to AAA, the business of distractions on the computer, I was writing notes to my friends, laughing at jokes, playing video games, all the rest in the back row with my friends. I shouldn't have been doing that, but those same kinds of distractions can happen in the classroom setting and often do as well. So I don't think that that's particularly unique. And the final thing I would say, just where I began, is this is just an option, folks. This is a menu item so that families can choose this if they want to. I might not choose it for my kid. You might not choose it for yours. But why shouldn't we join the other half of the United States that has this if we do it in a structured and well-regulated way? I think we have to do something different. You heard a great presentation here from my superintendent, Deborah Bowers, and others, and quality control experts saying, we got to think outside the box. We can't just do things differently all across education. I'm not on this committee. I don't pretend to have all of your expertise. This is just one tiny example. If we can't do it in this area where there's an actual backstop, where there's a test that if you got a bad education, whether it's at AAA or in the classroom or otherwise, you will not pass that permit test. If you don't know the difference between a yellow line and a white line, or the double line and the single line, or you don't know the sharp curve, you're not going to pass the test. That's the backstop. That's the safety point for all of us. You simply will not pass the test. And in any event, you always have to have behind-the-wheel training. This is only for the permit test, only for that objective information. So I leave it at that. I look forward, hopefully, to a discussion next year.
Thank you, Representative Simon. You know, one of the privileges of working in the House is that we often get into very difficult issues, and it isn't the getting into the difficult issues. It's being able to interact with often opposing sides that have terrific, wonderful information and integrity to the process. You all have done that. I appreciate that. I would encourage you in the interim to communicate with one another. Let's see what happens next year. Thank you very much.
Can I make one closing comment?
Very, very
okay, I just wanted to say that we do have a proven program that's been effective, and we want to make the streets safe. And the second question, which wasn't answered, is there any other company other than this that is teaching this online, or we just have one option?
I also do have that question. We will get an answer to that. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Could I just sneak in that Mr. Steinberg is a wonderful teacher? My kids have.
Yes, indeed, Representative Bailey.
And Chair, as the Chair of the Transportation Policy Committee, I appreciate this hearing, and I would be willing to do a joint hearing or any way
that's
we can. I think I'm the only member of both, and I think that the transportation folks could really benefit from hearing it from the perspective of the education concerned folks as well. So I just wanted to lay that out as a possibility. So thank you.
That's a wonderful idea. Members, we're going to go over the 12 o'clock that I had tried to do, which means I'm going to be late to my other meeting, but we still have two very terrific items and important items to cover. Representative Hosh, and I do apologize for the department because they were supposed to be first, but you know these sort of things. But thank you to the department for hanging in there with us. Representative Hosh, your bill, House Bill 3871, Social and Emotional Learning Standards. You have some witnesses, citizens, regular citizens, but that's why I want to jump to you right away. And again, we're not moving bills today, but we think this is an important issue that we probably will be vetting more carefully in the next legislative session. Representative Hosh. Representative Hosh, you are also aware, you know, we'll see, you know, who can do it the quickest and the best. But Representative Hosh, we are under tight time constraints, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Due to the committee time, I would like to let you know that two of the testifiers are not here, so maybe we can have a briefer testimony on this bill.
Thank you.
I will just give a very quick introduction on what House File 3871 does. It allows funding for districts who choose to compete for from grants, the ability to implement social emotional learning standards in several different ways. One, they can use the grants to train their teachers on SEL standards and curricula, develop social and emotional learning curricula, or integrate social emotional learning standards into their existing curricula. So this allows flexibility for the school district to do what they think is best fit for them. This is not a mandate. This is an initiative that's going to address standards for our students that not only focuses on academics, but also on their social and emotional health. And I think we know how important that is to the classroom learning experience. As the representative of the Ricori School District, who had to endure a tragedy a few years back ago, we can understand how bullying and other behavioral aspects can affect the classroom. And I think this is a good approach that we can take to allow school districts who are ready and willing to implement social emotional learning standards for the state to be a partner in that. With that said, I would like to hand this over to Ann McInerney, and allow her to actually talk about the details of the bill.
Welcome, Ms. McInerney, to the committee. Please state your name for our record and then give us your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Ann McInerney, and I'm a school social worker, and I'm here representing the Minnesota School Social Workers Association. We feel very strongly about social-emotional learning being implemented into the schools, and in fact, it already is. There are a number of different programs that whole school buildings, as well as individual personnel, implement with students, depending on their needs. As most of you, I'm sure, are well aware, there are a number of social-emotional and mental health concerns with students in schools. And as a school social worker, we work with students like that all the time. And we, school psychologists and school counselors, nurses, we all work hard at helping to identify students that are at risk of suicide and identify students that are victims of bullying, identify students who are not attending school because they feel that school is unsafe. Social-emotional learning would help combat that across the board in across the entire school. What social-emotional learning can also be individualized for every different school. Schools can look at their needs, determine what things they're needing to work on, pick a program, and implement it in the school. That's what this grant would do. It would give individual schools money to implement some kind of program. So programs such as bullying prevention, character education, health education, chemical use, anything like that. What we have seen across the United States of schools that have implemented social-emotional learning, they just recently came out with a statistic saying that children's academic performance on standardized tests has improved by 11% when these programs have been implemented in their school. I think one of your handouts will have some more of that, better school attendance and less disruptive behavior. It does just form a consistent way to handle discipline and a consistent way to deal with students who are having some difficulties. There are a number of other states who have also implemented social-emotional learning. Illinois is very far along. They have a number of standards that students early ed until they graduate would have to achieve. And then teachers and school service personnel would check the students to see how they're doing on each individual standard, and then you have that handout as well. We're not at this time asking for those standards. What we're asking for is to develop a grant program through the Department of Ed. I currently work in a school where we have social-emotional learning implemented, and as of right now, I work at a day treatment, so it's junior high students that have a diagnosed mental illness, so they're a difficult group and have traditionally been and isolated in a bigger school. But right now we have an attendance rate of 96%, and we have only had three suspensions all year. So the bullying is down, and the attendance is up, as well as their testing. The grant program would focus on early intervention and prevention, which, as we all know, is very important when you're working with students that are at high risk. Thank you.
Thank you. And welcome, sir. Will you be testifying as well?
Yes.
Wonderful.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair, committee members,
Friends of Mental Health. My name is George Realmuto. I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist. I'm a professor of psychiatry at the University of Minnesota. I'm also the medical director of the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Service of your state-operated services. I'm a clinician, I'm a teacher, I'm an administrator, I'm a researcher. My research brings in the small group of prevention scientists at the university. Behavioral prevention scientists bring about $2 million of federal money into the state. And we have developed prevention programs in 30 different elementary schools around the state, and we have also worked several times in Minneapolis with Coastal United Communities. I'm not here to talk about our prevention program, but one of the components of our prevention program is a social-emotional curriculum. Currently, we're using PATH. PATH stands for Promoting Alternate Thinking Strategies. And to just go quickly, the goals of PATH provides in-depth training for dealing with uncomfortable feelings such as sadness, frustration, anger, jealousy, while enhancing self-control and seeking strategies for making and keeping friends. When we have studied this component in our larger prevention program, we have obtained results that obtain an effect size of 0.3, which essentially means we lose children who were outside the norms of social functioning, one-third of a standard deviation closer to the norm. As a mental health person, I just want to tell you what the pathway is for kids who do not have competent social skills. They are rejected. Those rejected children continue to affiliate with other peers. Those other peers are also rejected. What do those peers do together? Well, they teach each other antisocial, non-social skills. The skills that lead them to drop out of school, use substances, become chemically dependent, get into the juvenile justice system, and cost the state of Minnesota millions and millions of dollars. The problem here is that prevention is a bottom feeder. All of your attention, most of my work is with very seriously emotionally disturbed children. That's why I'm medical director of CABHS. But I'm telling you, what you need to do is start early. These kinds of problems, chemical dependency, aggression, dangerousness, self-injury, suicidal behavior can be prevented. There are programs. Our program is endorsed by every federal agency that it can be endorsed by. National Institute of Drug Abuse, National Institute of Mental Health, the Department of Corrections, Juvenile Justice. You have never heard of early risers. I mean, Greeling has heard of it, but you guys have never heard of it, and you don't fund it. And we have such significant difficulty getting these programs throughout the state. If it wasn't for federal money, they wouldn't exist at all. And when the federal money runs out, they stop. I applaud this representative for putting this bill in. Grant money is terrific, but the sustainability continues to be a problem. Once the grant money runs out, it ends. I have a little vignette. Danny is a six-year-old and is exhibiting behavior problems in his kindergarten classroom and child care and after-school program. He is disruptive, hits and touches peers, argues with teachers, becomes easily frustrated, and has temper tantrums when things do not go his way. Danny is considered explosive and unpredictable. He's socially mature and disliked by his peers. Danny's parents have divorced several years earlier and are both remarried. He lives with his mother but sees his father regularly. The communication between Danny's parents is strained, and they differ in their opinion on how to handle Danny's behavior. Parents have different parenting styles and do not always provide Danny with clear and consistent boundaries across the two households. That same kid, at the conclusion of the program, upon graduation from Early Risers, I feel, this is mother's testimony, I feel compelled to give you my personal feedback on the program. My son Danny loves the Early Risers program. As a mother,
My observations are not based on test scores, but on his happiness and the way he chatters about his days and the activities he's worked on. When I picked him up from the summer program, he would run around gleefully playing with other children, often hugging them. I often feel guilty as a working single mother that I have to sacrifice time with him in order to provide for us. This, you know, where does kids learn social skills? They're being short trained because the adults in their lives have so many other things to do. However, my guilt and worries are so greatly reduced when I see him growing within the outstanding environment of early risers. Looking beyond all the social skills, academic, arts, crafts, field trips, and other programs, activities that he's exposed to, the most important factor is the success of the program, is the relationship my son has developed. So people like Ann, who work with these kids, develop these relationships. People learn social skills through relationships. A curriculum is important. The vehicle, the past program, or coping power, or the incredible years, there's a lot of evidence-based social-emotional learning programs. It needs to be in the context of an institution that's caring for them and a person who they know wants them to succeed. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Zalamonto. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, and thank you, Representative Haas and the testifiers, we had at one time the profile of learning, which was, you know, people love to hate, but I'm wondering, and part of it was because there was so much of it, but I'm wondering, we don't have Ms. Larson here, I hate to ask Mr. Strom another question that he doesn't know the answer to it. It's two in the same day, but does anyone here know if that included any social emotional standards in that comprehensive curriculum? Okay.
We're seeing a nod of no.
It did not. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions or thoughts?
Okay. I just deeply appreciate the fact that you are addressing these issues. I am the chief author of the bill in the House to have Prairie St. John's build a hospital in our Twin City area for children and adolescents, and also as a classroom teacher dealing with so many kids who are depressed. It's amazing because of being shuttled between two households. Again, as you said, difference in parenting styles, different rules, a lot of confusion around those things. I feel this is a sensitive issue, and I hope that we can take time to really explore how this can be implemented in our schools. Because it's a grant, it seems to me like it would be available to some, not to others. I'd rather see this integrated in a different way and maybe a more holistically way. But I do appreciate the fact that you are sensitive to the needs of our kids.
Perhaps, Ms. McInerney, you can share with us, I know it's only a part of it, but you can share with me, and I can share with the committee the Illinois model, their approach. That's intriguing to me. I think we do have, Dr. Efron, if you wanted to testify, you can come down. I would appreciate your brevity. You've been very good about that this year, so you understand our time constraints. And then, Representative Peterson, why don't you go ahead and ask your question and make your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask either one of the testifiers, we do have bullying policies, or at least legislation that was passed around the bullying issue, and districts have to have policies. Are those effective at all in getting at some of the issues in the schools, and are we able to use those programs effectively to intervene with some of the things you're talking about?
Yeah, and I'm wondering if we've even been able to assess the effectiveness of that. It's such a relatively new policy directive, at least from the state, but, you know, getting some sense of assessment of how that's working, Ms. McInerney?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question, and it is effective. It does help, and it does give schools and school districts a guideline and some incentive and some encouragement to provide those kind of services, absolutely. I think what we're really looking at is a more standardized way of assessing those programs and making sure that we're catching all of the students. Right now it's real, even as a school social worker belonging with the Minnesota Association, it's difficult to really assess which schools and what they're providing their students. It's just a lot of pockets and a lot of different programs. And so what this hopefully would do is kind of provide some kind of standardization and a way to really look at the effectiveness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm here on behalf of EdWatch to state briefly numerous and very strong concerns about this bill. Aside from the very concrete issues of cost, not now necessarily being a mandate, but eventually if this takes hold, a very crowded academic calendar that's already been discussed in the light of other standards such as physical education, the subjectivity of these standards, and you have the Illinois standards, and I'll just say, you know, one, recognize the feelings and perspectives of others. We are putting government schools in the role of determining how to do that when adults can't do it, when entire societies fight wars over those kinds of things. That doesn't make any sense. It's a usurpation of parental authority and an incredibly wrong expansion of government to do this kind of thing. But the most important thing is the difficulty in agreeing on what these standards are, what they mean, and how they could be implemented. And I'm going to give you just a very brief example of how that would affect freedom of thought and freedom of conscience. There was a study in 2003 that was published by Dost et al. That says that conservatives, those of politically conservative thought, are suffer from mental rigidity, closed-mindedness, decreased cognitive complexity, lowered self-esteem, aggression, etc., etc. Now, there are some on one political side of the aisle that might agree with that and think that that's a really good idea. On the other hand, there was just a book published in February of 2008 called The Liberal Mind by Dr. Charles Rossiter, who said, quote, "Modern liberalism's irrationality can only be understood as the product of psychopathology," and a number of other things. The problem is that psychiatry, psychiatric standards, diagnostic criteria are a matter of opinion. There is no science. Both of these perspectives are wrong, and to put these into our schools would be a fatal mistake. The National Institutes of Health, the National Institutes of Mental Health, the Surgeon General, the World Health Organization, all admit in their scientific medical documents that these criteria are subjective. They are value judgments based on culture. They are difficult to apply to children who rapidly change and develop. You cannot do it. In response to a study by the National Institutes of Mental Health, which said that 50% of Americans either have or will have a mental disorder. 50%, half of you, half of us will have a mental disorder. Dr. Paul McHugh, former chairman of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins, said, and he was one of my professors when I was there, he said, 50%, are you kidding me? Although the study may have been accurately done, the problem with the diagnostic manual, it is like a field guide. It is constantly expanding. He said, pretty soon we will have a syndrome for short, fat Irish guys with a Boston accent, and I will be mentally ill. If you do this kind of thing, you are endangering freedom of thought and freedom of conscience, no matter what
your political beliefs are. And as a very concrete example of that, the California state prison system is treating with antipsychotics as a delusional disorder what they consider extreme homophobia and racism. There is a move within the within the psychiatric community to make those diagnostic disorders in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual when it is published, when it publishes its next edition. I just strongly urge you to let this bill die now and leave it alone.
Thank you, Dr. Esselin. We are not moving bills today, Dr. Realmonto, and then we're gonna move on. Go ahead.
That was a terrific speech for why there's so much stigma around mental illness. It's horrible. As a scientist, and here's a doctor who also understands the scientific method, we were talking about differences between social skill building in a group that got a curriculum and those that didn't. I didn't say anything about the psychiatric diagnosis. I said things that result in the use of substances. Substances are addictive products. Aggression, self-injury. I did not mention diagnosis. That social skill building is an important function that all of us need to be healthy, to have good relationships, and to be successful. That's what I was talking about. That's what I studied as a prevention scientist, and those are the outcomes through randomized clinical trials. We have determined that social-emotional curriculum are very important in that role.
Thank you. I'm going to stop there. We most likely will see this bill at some point. Assuming, Representative Haas, that you and I are back here again next year, we will give it all the deliberative attention. Representative Haas, why don't you close this out here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This is a very important bill. In no way are we talking about diagnosis or any of that sort. On a personal note, as a child growing up and going through the school system and having challenges and being one of the recipients of the actions of bullies and having to deal with some speech issues and just, you know, the same issues that any child goes through in the younger years, the involvement of my teachers and my parents in being able to explain to me and also work with me through some of the concerns that I had as a young child were instrumental to who I am today. And I think we have a responsibility and a duty to make sure that we can provide that kind of help to our students throughout the state of Minnesota. We know through evidence and through other trials that this can be a success, not only for the child, but also for the classroom and for the schools by reducing the achievement gaps, making sure that there's less disruptions in the classroom, reducing tardiness or absences. This is a good bill. I know we're not moving this forward, but I look forward to having a debate on this in the next legislative session.
Thank you, Representative Haas. There were so many folks who had questions and thoughts, and it tells me that we will have a rich discussion at a future time. I do apologize to members. We have one final item on the agenda, and I want to thank all the testifiers, by the way, on this issue just now. Minnesota Department of Education, we want to talk about the grad exam in regards to language arts. Provision which will be added this year to the grad exam and I think effective for this this year's diploma conference. And a number of members have expressed some kind of anxiety and concerns about and questions about the grad exam, and so we thought this would be a wonderful opportunity to do kind of a 101 on what's happening with the grad exam, and then I hope that we will in fact I'll have members be able to have questions. We are at our 12 o'clock time, but this is an important issue, members, and if you can hang in there for 15, 20 minutes, I think it'll be a really good discussion. And so with that, why don't we start in, and Assistant Commissioner, if you could state your name for the record and get us going, that'd be great.
My name is Christy Hovannis Schwaswa. I am the Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Education. I have with me two members of the Commissioner's Assessment and Accountability Stakeholders Committee meeting. They wanted to provide testimony after the fact, but in the interest of time, just had them sit here. So if you have questions through the presentation, you can feel free to stop and ask them as well.
And Assistant Commissioner, I just want to, my staff reminded me that I misspoke. The language arts provision is not to be effective for this diploma conferring year. It's for students who are currently in the 10th grade. Is that correct?
That I have a slide to specifically
what?
Address that question.
Okay, good. I just want to clarify my, correct my statement of the record. So, please proceed.
Okay. Again, a reminder of how the grad is administered. It's the first administration of the grad assessment for students is embedded into our MCA 2 assessment. Rather than giving two separate assessments, we're just giving students one assessment. It's an 85-item assessment. 50 items are counted towards the MCA score, 40 items are counted towards the grad score, and there are 20 sealed items that the student takes. As the student retakes the grad assessment, they're only taking 40 items that are supposed to be on the grad assessment. The grad and the MCA will be likely on different scales. You're familiar now with the MCA scale for 10th grade, which is 1,000 to 1,100 as the range of points. The grad scale has not been determined yet because we have not actually administered the grad and gotten results back yet. So it will look like a different scale. There are 25 items that are on both the MCA assessment and count for the grad assessment. There are 25 items that are on the MCA assessment only that are not on the grad assessment, and there are 15 items that are on the grad assessment that are not on counted towards the MCA assessment. So they are two different tests, but they're put together as one assessment for students to take in the spring. As you know, the grad assessment replaces the BSC assessment. For any student who was in 8th grade in 2005, 6, or later. So for 9th grade, the writing grad was in effect last year in 2006 and 7, and students had to earn a passing score of 3 or higher in order to meet the graduation requirement for writing. This year in 2007-8, the spring administration, 10th graders will be taking the reading grad for the first time to satisfy their graduation requirements. So they were 9th graders last year who took the writing grad. The 10th graders this year will be taking the reading grad. And then next year, the math grad will come online for the 11th grade students. Passing scores for the reading grad for 10th grade will be determined as soon as we have our results back from this year's administration. We have started work on establishing the passing score. We've had a public comment period that started in January. We've assembled stakeholders to review the content and material and data that we've been able to gather so far on items that are going to be appearing on the grad. The stakeholders have made a recommended cut to the Commissioner of Education, and we are waiting for the data back in May to re-present this to our local assessment and advisory committee to demonstrate how the current recommended cut will look against real live data. And once that meeting has happened, they will make a confirmatory recommendation, and the commissioner will then establish or continue moving through the rulemaking process to establish the cut score. I want to provide some caveats on the data that I'll be sharing or providing with you with respect to what it will look like or the data that the stakeholders have been looking at. We currently have reading grad data for students from last year. When we put together our assessments last year, we placed the grad items in our MCA assessment as some of our field test items. So those 20 items that don't count for either the grad score or the MCA score, we test those items in order to get information about how well those items perform and if they're a valid and reliable measure of student performance. We had those items and we While putting each of those items on the test, we were able to pull together a sample data of approximately 8,000 completed grad assessments. So there is no single student in the state of Minnesota last year that took a full grad exam. They took a few questions that would appear on the grad, some questions that would appear on the MCA, and we pieced those questions together to get 8,000 completed exams. The data that we'll be showing you is unmotivated student data, or something that we're talking about is unmotivated student data. While there's motivation for schools to meet AYP and districts to meet AYP, there is no student motivation currently associated with the results we're getting back from grad, because last year it was not a graduation requirement. This year it will be a graduation requirement. What this means is other states have done studies that demonstrate that when there are student-level stakes attached to an assessment, two particular states that we looked at and several others, one of the states, the lowest performing state, showed that there was an 8% increase in the percent of students proficient once the student motivation factor was included. Another one of the states that was on the high end demonstrated that there was an 18% in the percent of 18% increase in the percent of students proficient as soon as it became a student stakes test. So what this means is the proficiency that we saw last year for reading MCAs will likely go up this next year, and the data I'll be showing you with regards to mapping it to the grad expectations will also be likely increased next year based on past practice in other states for student motivation effects. The other thing is that this is first attempt data only. Students have opportunities to continuously retake the grad, and the information we'll only be showing is a first attempt, so if they were taking it the first time. I also mentioned that the grad scale is likely going to be a different scale than MCA, so these are not mapped perfectly, and I'll show you on one of the next slides what that means. To preface this, I wanted to share the DST passing rates historically. You see a 1996 progression to a 2005 progression. What this shows is in 1996, when the DST graduation requirement was first established, it required that 70% of the items are responded to correctly on the DST in order for the student to meet the graduation requirement. When 70% rule was in effect, there were just about 64% of students in 8th grade who passed the BST on their first attempt. In 1997, you all know that that increased to a 75% of responses had to be correct on the BST in order to meet the graduation requirement, which is why you see a bit of a drop to 59% of students passing on their first BST attempt. You'll see as recently as 2005, which is the last year of data we have, 85% of students passed the BST on their first attempt. So 10 years into the program, 85% were passing on their first attempt. The reason the data ends at 2005 is because students enrolled in 8th grade in 2005-06 are under the new grad requirement. So we have a gap in the data because they start with the grad requirement and no longer were required to take the BST in 2006 or 2007, which is why we don't have that data. What this chart shows is, in the first column, you'll see that we mapped the grad items, or the scores on the grad assessment, to what the concordance score would be on the MCA 2. And we had talked initially when we started the grad setting process is that we would never set a passing score on grad that would be higher than the proficiency score on MCA 2, because a proficient score on MCA 2 satisfies the graduation requirement. We also had discussed that we would not set a grad requirement that fell in the does not meet standards category. So the range you see here from 1040 to 1050 is the concordance score on the MCA for the students who are partially meeting standards. These students are not proficient on the MCA, so they have not met their graduation requirement that way, and these students are not in the does not meet category. The next column shows the number of correct responses they provided to the items. So for a score of 1040, or that break point between does not meet and partially meet, it means that the student is responding to 22 items out of 40 items correctly on the grad assessment. For about 55% of the items would be correct. If this were the standard that were set for high school graduation, it means that 83% of the students would pass on their first attempt based on unmotivated student data. On the very bottom, you see 1050. That's the cut point between students who are partially proficient on MCA 2 and students who are proficient on MCA 2. And what that means is that they responded to 29 out of the 40 items correctly on the grad, which means they responded to 73% of the items correctly. At this passing score, approximately 61% of students would pass on their first attempt with unmotivated data. And I keep saying first attempt unmotivated data because if we go back to the BSP slide, this is first attempt but motivated data, and you can see we started at about 64% passing in that first year, dropping down to 59%, but then got up to 85% or close to 85% in 2005. So if we're looking at information on the current grad that we've pulled together from sample data, we are looking at if we set a cut score of 1040 and it has a passing rate right now of 83%, that's unmotivated. If we add 8 to 18%, it gets you up to 91 and over 100% of kids passing on their first time. And if we set it at 1050, we're looking at 69 to 79% of students passing it on their first attempt.
Yes, Mr. Commissioner, 1050 again is that area that's between proficient and partially proficient, and the 1040 is?
Does not meet standards and partially meet standards. And so we have the option of working through when we get our actual data in May to see what our actual student motivation effect was. Was it closer to the 8% or closer to the 18%? And reevaluate this data using actual student data that we have rather than sample data that we've been able to collect. You'll notice that three lines are grayed out. As we're mapping a concordance score from grad over to MCA, you'll see that there are two MCA scores that are the same as 22 items correct. On the grad. Because the grad only has 40 items, it does not map perfectly to a 100-point range. So there are some scores that are going to match to different scales. And as we do this, so what this basically means is we could never set a cut score at 1041, 1045, or 1048 if we're looking to map it onto the MCA too. So we will likely have a different scale for grad to alleviate some of these inconsistencies. We're also asked to talk about the remediation and retake opportunities. Since 1996, there has been a requirement that districts have to provide remediation for students who have not passed the BSP and be able to provide them the skills that they need in order to retake that BSP test to make graduation. The grad, we also anticipate that this law would continue in effect and that districts would be required to provide remediation. There's a proposal that once the student retakes the grad, we will have their test scores back within 2 weeks and then provide 6 weeks at least at a minimum for remediation depending on the teacher's or the instructor's best judgment as to whether or not that student's able to retake or should be retaking the grad at that time. This Department of Education will be offering the grad on a monthly basis. So students will not be able to take it every single month because remediation needs to occur. It will be provided on a monthly basis, so students do not have to be on the same remediation schedule or may allow for more time between those 8 weeks of administration. That's in a nutshell, where we are right now. So we are anxiously anticipating getting back our results in May to conclude this process.
Thank you. There are a couple questions, but let me ask this very generally. And this is probably a much bigger question than, this is a broad policy question, but should there be or is there an intent for the cut score on the grad, whatever that level is going to be, to have a relationship with basic entry-level employment skills, I know that's very broad, and or post-secondary, entry post-secondary readiness, if you will. So readiness for work or readiness for So, I mean, maybe tell us a little bit briefly about how the group and you know the department is wrestling with that particular issue or not. I mean, ultimately, that gets to the whole issue of relevancy about, you know. So, yeah, I mean, we can talk about it in terms of just, you know, comparing it to well, it's an issue of relevancy in terms of what is it that we're handing out for readiness for work or for post-secondary. Say a little bit about what the department and perhaps the stakeholder group is, how they've wrestled with that issue.
Can I, Mr. Chair, can I just step out of my
question? Sure. Oh, okay.
Specific?
Sure, Representative Flowers.
For example, my son is actually played through Century, right, to get in, and he did get recommended because he struggles with some remedial work. But he passed, he's back in the BSC group, he passed all that. So it is sort of like the frustration on, they're taking all these tests and doing all this, but then they go to take an acupuncture to get into placement at a college and don't get in there, and then have more remedial work again. So it's, yeah, how it's when the rubber meets the road in reality, kind of what you're saying.
Right. And I imagine the same question, you know, can be asked with just, I mean, and not pick on the grad test, but, you know, the MCA, for that matter.
We're into picking on tests. That's a really good question, and it's something that the P16 partnership has been working on, and something that the Commissioner's Assessment and Accountability Stakeholders Committee has been working on. And I think one of the main consensuses is there's not a single test that can accomplish all of those things. The GRAD assessment is really designed, and standards are set based on what is the minimum amount of stuff students need to know in order to earn a high school diploma. And that is the only question that is being asked when we're trying to determine a cut score for grad. The NCA choose has a little bit different, different perspective when they're setting their proficiency cut scores. They're saying, what do students need to know to be proficient on the Minnesota academic standards? And I think this is evidenced by the where we're even starting to look for a cut score. With respect to the grad, is that we're looking in the partially meet standards category rather than in the meet standards or exceed standards category. So the grad test is designed and has been designed to be a more advanced assessment, more than just minimum skills as the basic skills test had been, but has not moved yet to the level of MCA of assessing truly what are the proficient or academic skills the student needs to know to be proficient, but more of a minimum.
Mr. Chair and Assistant Commissioner, I have one very simple kind of a yes-no question, and then I've got a whole bunch of others. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that you like getting picked on about tests. my question is, are the MCA 2s and the grad tests required by the No Child Left Behind Act to comply with federal No Child Left Behind?
That's two questions, so can I have a yes and a no? MCA 2, yes, is required by No Child Left Behind. Grad, no, it is not required by No Child Left Behind.
So a graduation... excuse me, Mr. Chair. So graduation, a grad test requirement for a diploma is not a required, not required by the No Child Left Behind Act.
That is correct.
Thank you. Now I'm not done. Can you tell me on the testing that you've done, what percentage of students in each major racial income subgroup would pass the grad test at this point?
We do have that data back at the department, and we would be willing to share that. My observation of the data is it looks very similar to students who are not passing the BSP or passing the BSP at the first attempt. So there is a gap in achievement between our overall and our white and our black, our white and our economically disadvantaged students. But that gap looks very similar to the other gaps that you will see for other assessments.
Mr. Penn spoke of, my understanding is that that also holds in other states where similar instruments are being used.
Okay. What strategies do you believe the school should use to help students pass the test before they graduate from high school? And does the department do anything to help these schools achieve these strategies to get kids past it?
Certainly we have several strategies in place with respect to instruction and improving student achievement, but to specifically prescribe what districts should be doing, we believe it's a local decision on how they remediate their students, that we won't be prescriptive, though we will be providing information on best practice and what other districts are currently doing.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Assistant Commissioner, I've authored an appeals process, as you know, and I'm very interested in seeing that with a new test like this, there is a ramp-up period, and to allow kids, to not punish kids who have done all the right things. And so are there other states that are doing appeal processes with grad-related tests? Or MCHUs, for that matter, but the grad test in particular, where a child is penalized if they've sat in class, done all the right classwork, and they can't get by this test at this point. What are other states doing to ensure that as many kids succeed as should?
I cannot speak to what all other 50 states are doing. I know that some other states do have a process whereby they can use a concordance score on either the ACT or SAT that would demonstrate that they've successfully met a similar or a concordance score as what's required on the high school graduation test. I am not aware, though I have not researched all 50 states, of other appeals type processes.
Here's thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson, and we should indeed carefully look at what's happening. Assistant Commissioner, when we met just the other day, you also reminded me that none of this replaces the course requirements and the GPA requirements that are essential for the conference of a diploma. So I just wanted to, you're nodding, so I just wanted to get that up. Members, any other questions or thoughts?
Just Commissioner, could you just remind me again, when do they take grad tests and when do they take MCA? I've forgotten.
The first administration of the grad is embedded into the MCA 2, which is starting next week, Monday, in our school.
What grade?
Grade 10 for reading, and next year will be grade 11 for math. And last year was grade 9 for writing.
Representative Flowers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the Assistant Commissioner. Just along the lines of what we were talking about, I hope you'll look at the testing lining up at entry college level testing, and then to the, that's when they're starting to have to pay for the remedial work in college. And anyway, it's just very frustrating if it would line up better and they could take courses in high school and pass the test and pass the college entrance test without having to, it's just not seamless. And doesn't that make sense? Or is that a goal to line to just so where we can do the college, also be college ready for those tests and for the workplace if they're going there?
That
is a goal. I don't think any state has accomplished that particular feat yet. As I mentioned, we had been working in the P16 partnership and also in the Commissioners of Assessment and Accountability Stakeholders Group, and had started conversations and dialogues about what type of assessment or what assessment would be used to do a college-ready type indicator. And even, I believe, among the higher ed institutions, there's disagreement as to which assessment should be used for college readiness. So I know we experienced the same thing at the state level. There's been talk about using ACT or SAT or ACCESSOR or even plan in the PSAT as predictors for college success and readiness, but nothing for admissions decisions. And then there was also a long conversation about the difference between admissions decisions being made based on an assessment versus placement decisions. You might meet the math requirements for admission, but then you get there and you don't know which math course to enroll in, so you would be taking a placement assessment as well. So there's several different assessments that we've looked at and explored to try and streamline a high school student's assessment process, but they're all very specific functional assessments.
Mr. Chair, I just hope you'll continue to look at that. Intellectually, it makes so much sense, but I know on the ground it's a lot harder.
So, Sister Commissioner, we talked about this the other day. So, the cut score is not set yet.
No.
At what point, again, do you expect that to happen? And when we talked, you talked about, you know, being able to look at what the results were. Maybe you can just say briefly again.
We anticipate having data and information back from our test company by May 29th, at which point we'll be able to review and look at the data again.
And then my final question has to do with, so the following year we'll be setting that for the math expectations, and not to belittle the language arts. I mean, that's a rigorous discipline in and of itself, but I'm imagining, and certainly given, that regardless of how you measure it, math is often the toughest meaning as interpreted in terms of, percentages of students passing certain benchmarks, and that's true all over the country. So my question is, are we going to what degree will the decisions that are made this year in regards to where that cut score is for language arts, to what degree will that inform where that might be set for math, or do we need to approach the math issue from a different perspective, given the history of student performances on math in general?
It may be premature to answer this question, given that we don't know motivation effects and we don't know retest effects yet for the reading grad. And though those assessments are very different, I'm assuming that we will probably maintain the same principles, as we would not set anything higher than proficient, nor would we set anything in a does not meet standards setting. So it would probably fall within the same range of the 1140 to 1150 that we'd be evaluating to set a cut score for graduation.
But where you'll set it will not be de facto determined by where this one will be set.
No, they will be. It will be an independent standard setting process.
Okay, thank you. Members, any other questions or thoughts? Welcome.
Mr. Chair, sorry, one more, and it's quick. Assistant Commissioner, we live in a mobile society. What happens to some poor kid who moved here in 11th grade or 12th grade from Wisconsin, and he takes this grad test, doesn't pass it? He hasn't been educated in Minnesota with our standards, with our education system. What happens to him? Is he denied a diploma then from my school?
Well, Assistant Commissioner.
In order to earn a standard high school diploma, they do need to meet the grad requirements.
So Representative Spoken, that potentially could be a growing issue for us, given the mobility mm-hmm. issues. And it's not even other states, it's other nations, as our immigrant populations continue to grow. And then you add the added issue of language proficiency and the impact of that on any of our standardized tests. Certainly an issue.
Interesting.
Well, members, again, I don't know if I'll be chairing this committee in that session or not, but if I am, we will certainly stay focused on addressing these issues and vetting these out, and look forward to ongoing engagement with both the department and stakeholders in the community as we continue to do that. And thank you for your testimony today, and apologies again. We originally wanted you to go right away first, but it didn't work out that way.
On behalf of my waistline, I would like to thank the chairman for the goodies this morning.
My pleasure, and it's been my pleasure to chair this committee through these last two sessions. You're all, I've been very humbled because you all know a heck of a lot more than I do, and so I kind of see myself more as a traffic cop, but, you know, you guys are wonderful traffic to be trying to directly intersect with here, so I appreciate the work and the passion and the rigor and the strong commitment that you all have to our public education system, system here in the state of Minnesota. It has been my privilege and honor to be your chair. I do need one item here, and perhaps this is Demery, if you could move the minutes of our March 14th, is that right? Wow.
Here, I just want to move
there is a motion to adopt the minutes of March 14th. All discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And with that, members, we are adjourned. Yeah.